Howdy, everybody. It's your friend Dan in Little Saigon, Seattle, and it's Monday, Memorial Day, May the 27th, 2019. I had a couple days off, and tomorrow I have to go back to work. I'm really dreading it. The only peace I'm finding in this job is that somewhere in the dark abyss of this absurdity, of this triviality, of the ephemera of software engineering, somewhere in the cracks I can still hide. Because there is a lot of chaos out there. Notice I didn't say anarchy. Anarchy is not chaos. I said chaos. There's a lot of chaos out there, and there's a lot of chaos in organizations like Willy Wonka's, a lot of things going on. So I suppose the only thing that brings me peace with respect to my job is that there's just enough chaos that I think I'll probably have it for a few months. And this will allow me to save money for rent and food and maybe buy me another 6 or 7 month window if I lose this contract at some point. And I suppose that means that in February of 2020, I'll probably be in a similar state to what I was in February of 2019. I'm kidding, right? But am I? It's a job. I should be thankful. I'm almost 50 years old. It's a job. You know, it's a computer programming job. And it makes money. And I can buy things. And I can buy whatever crapola I need to shove down my mouthpipe to make it through another day. I can go to the cafeteria and get that healthy, nutritious food that tears the insides out of me. I can do all the things that are normal if I have the normal person money and the normal person job, normal, whatever the fuck that means, normal according to some really strange Seattle criteria. But I'm certainly not normal. Yes, yeah, so it's Memorial Day. Another thing too is I don't really want to say Happy Memorial Day. It's a day of grieving to me. It's a day of sadness. No matter how you see it, I don't care if you're a hardcore Republican or Democrat or voter status type who believes in every war we fight, or if you're someone like myself and thinks most of these, if not all of these wars, are monuments to human stupidity. Whatever your feelings are about war itself, what you're dealing with on Memorial Day is the death of men and women in combat. What you're doing is you're memorializing Americans who died in wars, who died in combat. So yeah, I don't really think it's very happy. I think it's worth noting, it's worth thinking about. I think you should meditate on it. If you're a Christian, I think you should say a prayer for peace. But beyond that, that's all I want to say. I will say the first topic for this podcast, which will, I don't know, could occupy a fair portion of it, and in that sense could be the core theme, sort of deals with the topic of Memorial Day, or I should say war. It does deal with that topic. I have mentioned before that for most of my life, probably going back to when I was a kid, I've had this strange, queer sense that there was something just really, really wrong with the way things worked in the world. That it just didn't function correctly, that there was something behind the scenes. And for most of my life, which was a secular life, I was an atheist most of my life. For most of my life, that something behind the scenes was, you know, whatever. Some type of bureaucratic bullshit, some type of government bullshit. If only we could get government under control. But I think it's uglier than that and darker than that. I think for most of my life, I kind of sense that the civilization or society I was born into was nearing an apogee, or at least a period of change. And change is not always bad. You know, this is something to keep in mind in all these conversations that people have about the future. and discussions about how things could change. Yeah, things could change radically. I'm of the opinion that whatever happens next is going to be radical. We're not looking at incrementalism any longer. It's either going to be a radical shift towards a kind of hyperstatism, which scares the shit out of me, really, because so many Americans are just geared for it. So many Americans are ready to adopt a kind of hyper-statist society, a society of cameras everywhere, a society of implanted chips, a society of food schedules, a society of reminders and digital manipulation, which is really where we're already at. It's just we're in beta testing. And so a lot of Americans will jump on board that particular dystopia. You know, or it can be something radically different from that. It could be the disintegration of the American Empire. And if it happens in a peaceful way, if the American Empire can kind of collapse upon itself or into itself, and if the United States has a chance at something like a freer society, then really the outcome could be positive. But the point is this, is that whatever's happening next, I really don't think it's more of the same. I don't think that I don't really know what's going to happen in the 2020 election, but I'm of the opinion that the 2020 presidential election is going to be epic, and it's going to be epic in ways that a lot of Americans are not going to like. But that, too, is really not the core subject of this first topic. I'm going to tell you that I kind of believe, well, I really do believe, I mean, you know, of the various futures, and I've talked about this before, I wrote an essay for my blog in 2015 that's now in PDF on my website at dfgtc.org. If you go to the tab that says words and you right-click F to find something in the page, you could type the word odds of or success, or I should say odds of survival. Just type in the word survival, and you'll come up with an essay in PDF form about the subjects. And I call these the napkin estimates, because I was having lunch with some computer programmers in Indianapolis in 2015, and we were talking about the future. And I was saying, you know, let's just do the back of the napkin estimates. And I will say that, you know, the estimates I provided were for a future that was less horrific than the one I'm about to talk about. But the one I'm about to talk about, if you're going to ask me, of all the possible futures, and this is why, if you have an issue with adult conversations about things like life and death, I would probably stop the podcast right now. But then again, if you've been listening to me the last few months, I don't think you have issues like that. I don't think you get freaked out. That's number one. Number two, as always, I'm just some dude, okay? I am just some dude like you. Whatever opinion I have is my opinion. So if you listen to this and you get all freaked out, you need to remember that I am just an ordinary, everyday human being with an opinion. There is no guarantee that I am right. And between you and I hope I'm wrong. You know, because the most likely future, and the one I'm going to talk about, is pretty terrible, mainly because it's filled with so many unknowns that there's just no way to make a prediction about. I believe at this point that in the next 5 years, there is about an 80% chance that there's going to be a nuclear war. Now, the reason for the nuclear war, there could be many reasons, and the causes could be many causes. I have to say that in terms of a chessboard of instability, the chessboard of instability is set up pretty well right now. India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons. They're kind of on a hair trigger. They have a lot of issues on their borders. And Kashmir, as an issue, has never gone away. There's been a lot of warmongering towards Russia since 2014. I have no idea why. It's funny, most of it's coming from the left in the United States. It's really fucked up. It makes me wonder, you know, it's funny, 10, 20, 30 years ago, when I was at UW campus, and you had folks from the Christic Institute and people talking about Central America, if you started talking about Russia the way a lot of lefties and Democrats are talking about Russia today, the lefties and Democrats of 1989 would have probably taken a swing at you and called you some kind of a fucking jackass. You know, they would have called you a McCarthyite. And here's the thing. I'm not saying I'm a huge fan of the lefties of 1989, but they would have been way closer to the fucking truth. Okay? And frankly, and they stood on pretty solid ground vis-a-vis U.S. empire in Central America. So anyways, there's been a lot of warmongering towards Russia that only makes sense in the logic of the military-industrial complex and the empire. It makes no sense in terms of human survival. And Seattle, oh my gosh. Seattle is a home for people who consciously or unconsciously on some level really support the war party. I mean, this is a war party city. And what's really horrible is that they'll say they believe in peace and shit and they'll talk about it. But if you start asking them about the pie chart of where their economic money comes from, it'll be like, well, you can't fucking take that away from me. Don't take away my Raytheon contract or my Boeing contract. Don't take away my Facebook deep state CIA contract. Don't take away my Amazon Web Services contract for the CIA. Don't take away my Microsoft government contracts. The point is, once you start explaining to them how much of the warfare state pays for their latte, yeah, a lot of them get upset and they don't want to talk anymore. Oh, you're saying that my bullshit is really bullshit. Yeah, your bullshit is bullshit. Your society, your economy is fueled by destruction. Not all of it's destruction, but enough of it. The part that is buying your home right now. Anyways. And then there's the warmongering with China. And the Chinese situation, and I've spoken about this in the past, the Chinese situation is interesting for historical reasons. China, and again, you know how they say some, I think there's a famous quote, I don't know who said this, but, you know, often history rhymes. It's not necessarily that history repeats, but it rhymes. And this has been said before. The following scenario is a case of where history may rhyme, not repeat. But if you look at the years leading up to the Russo-Japanese War, the War of 1905, the war where, you know, a lot of really racist white people would have said, oh, there's no way the Russians could lose to the Japanese. But the Japanese won that war. And they won that war for a number of reasons, not least of which they had some better naval technology. Now, I don't know what would happen between a war between China and the United States, but I will say this. There are some similarities. And I will say there are also some similarities between China's situation today and the situation of Japan in the 1930s. Okay? China is in a tough situation. And let's just be blunt. China's not a free society. China is a totalitarian society that has been experimenting with a kind of, you know, quasi-market policy for about 30 years. They've had a kind of capitalist system, a kind of free market, but in no way could you call them a free market. That would be insanity. They are a totalitarian society, and one of the ways in which the Communist Party in China maintains control is through something called prosperity. Prosperity, okay? If things are going well, people are okay. It's like, yeah, maybe we don't have all these freedoms and bullshit, but look at my brand new car. The Communist Party of China maintains control through prosperity and through growth. As long as there's economic growth, as long as people have jobs, as long as people are able to dream and fantasize about some type of quasi-American middle-class existence for the entire planet, but, you know, not least of which the billions in China. As long as those things are true, the system works. But China's facing some tough times economically. You know, a lot of people have been piling on Kyle Bass for being skeptical about China, for not being a China hawk, for basically saying that the Chinese economy, and specifically the financial system in China, could very well be a house of cards. And you know, he's bright. He is right. about that. But what he tends to dismiss, I think, as many analysts do, is that the entire world right now is kind of like that. So that's the thing. You know, when you talk about China and their situation vis-a-vis debt, you really can't exclude the planet. The whole planet is in a very tough situation vis-a-vis debt right now. So anyways, China's in a tough situation. The United States is very much an empire that I think is in decline. I think we've been in decline since the first Gulf War. People look at the first Gulf War and they see that as a sign of success. I think that's bullshit. If you actually have a sense of history, the first Gulf War was a sign of weakness. It was a sign that our ability to avoid wars on our periphery, to avoid wars on the edge of empire, that our ability to do that was no longer a thing. We couldn't do it. For decades, we could use money to simply make things happen. This is the thing. When the Romans started fighting more and more battles where their client states used to fight them for them, basically, when the Romans started spending more and more time sort of plugging the holes in the wall, plugging the holes in the dike, this was the sign that things were going bad. And this began to happen in the second century AD. It would take a couple hundred years, but things, you know, I think things move more quickly these days. So yeah, I would say the first Gulf War was really a sign of weakness. It was a sign that the empire could no longer just make things happen through money and through essentially through a kind of diplomatic subterfuge. We basically had to do the brute force thing. We had to slug it out to make somebody do what we wanted them to do, to change policy, essentially. So yeah, the first Gulf War was a sign of weakness, and everything since then has been imperial decline. Empires in decline, that is an old story for war, and certainly one of the causes of World War I, you could argue, one of the principal causes of World War I was that several empires were both in decline and in collision. So think about that. You know, the United States is a kind of empire. We are both in decline and in collision. We are in collision with China. We are in collision with Russia. And frankly, I could see ourselves getting into a collision state with Europe, depending upon what happens there. So anyways, if you look at the world today, and don't get me started on Israel. Israel has nuclear weapons. I cannot imagine a scenario where Israel would hold back from using nukes if a nuke was used on them. If any nuke goes off in Israel, Israel will use nukes. And in a way, you kind of have to get it. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Israel. I think they're a pretty shitty country overall. But, you know, it's not a very big country. So one or two nukes and most of Israel is just basically gone. Okay, there is no Israel. So yeah, you know, if you look at the world today, it's a very unstable chessboard. And there are lots of players. And the old mutually assured destruction thing, I mean, if that ever really did work, like if that was a thing, it doesn't really apply when you're dealing with game theory models that involve more than two players. This is the space, in terms of linear algebra, in terms of the mathematics of game theory. This is that region of mathematical space where none of the functors intersect, where you cannot make more than two of those functions intersect. The problem is that you're dealing with many players, many functions. And so you have a very unstable space. And within that unstable space, in mathematical terms, anything can and will happen. And then you have this. You have evidence, and let me talk about the evidence. The evidence is open to interpretation, but let me give you one example. I brought this up before, but I think it's worth mentioning. Fukushima. Whatever your thoughts on Fukushima are, and again, I don't know if you're someone who believes it's a ongoing catastrophe. I think it is an ongoing catastrophe. I really do. I think we're being lied to about it. Yeah, but whatever your feelings are about it, one thing is certainly true. Or at least one thing is true according to what they tell us. It is a real event and it happened. And it is ongoing. It continues to dump highly toxic, highly radioactive water into the ocean every fucking day. You know, ice wall, no ice wall, all the fucking bullshit they're doing, it's still an ongoing disaster. So, and I really, from day one, I never saw a lot of urgency. It was kind of like, it seemed like all that the media and our government wanted to do was just sort of pretend it didn't happen. So yeah, I would tell you straight up that Fukushima, for me, is one of those indications that the powers that be have kind of given up on the Pacific Ocean. And here's the thing, if you are in a world, in a situation, as a plebe, as an ordinary schmuck, and the people that run the world, or I should say the crocodile no longer cares about whether or not one of the biggest bodies of water on its planet is being turned into a toilet bowl, then you have to ask yourself, well, what does the crocodile have planned? So I do think Fukushima is curious. By itself, it's not a good enough reason. The other thing is that there's a lot of the term they're using is populist. Populist is kind of a derogatory term. Calling something populist isn't that far from calling people deplorable. You know, Hillary Clinton's code speech, code language, from 2016 was pretty clear. She despised the schmucks, the little people. She really did just want to have an America run by, you know, Seattle, San Francisco, New York City, and Washington, D.C. I think that, you know, that, you know, in L.A., but a few major cities with the right kinds of people, the rest of the country could just go to hell from Hillary Clinton's perspective. So people are kind of in revolt right now, and it's getting worse. I think that within 5 years, if something significant doesn't change with the world economy, the ability of the powers that be to paper over and hide the inflation and hide the unemployment and hide the depression. Because here's the deal, folks. We have been in a global depression for at least 10 years. It is papered over with a lot of debt. There is a ton of debt. There is a ton of economic Formigasket and Bondo. And if you don't know what Formigasket and Bondo are, they're gunk you buy when you're trying to fix an old car. But basically, we have papered over this rickety, rackety jalopy of a world economy. We have used a lot of Bondo and a lot of Formigasket, and it's starting to smoke again. So yeah, we've been in a global depression, and people are at their breaking point. And at some point, no amount of smartphones or smart devices or gender intersectional wars or any of that bullshit is going to trump a person's ability to buy food, in the very least, healthy, nutritious food, and have access to water and, you know, air that isn't filled with toxins for 3 weeks out of the year. Which, guess what? When the fires start up here around Seattle in a few months, yeah, I'll have the joy of something I never experienced in Washington State growing up. Almost a month out of the year when you can barely breathe. Yeah, that wasn't something that happened when I was a kid, folks. Sorry. So fucking sorry. The entire West Coast lit up with fires and firestorms. Not something that happened when I was a kid. So if you're asking me, have I experienced strange phenomena? Well, yeah, I have. I have. And I don't know what the real cause is, but what I can tell you is that I know when my lungs are working hard to breathe. Anyways, so people are pretty close to the breaking point. And then there's the debt thing. I think economically, I don't see how the debt situation resolves itself. It seems to me to be a giant financial scheme through, and the only safe exit for the people that caused this disaster, the only safe exit I can imagine is everyone forgetting. Like, if they could slip a Mickey into our water and convince us that none of it ever happened, that somehow everything that happened was an accident. But I really don't see that working. I just mention that because that's how whimsical you have to get. So the debt situation. And then there's the AI robotics hustle, which I do think is kind of a hustle, okay? I work with computers, yes. Machine intelligence is a real thing. But do I think machines are even remotely close to taking over the world? No. Do I think machines are close enough to supply all the slave labor that the elite would want? Yes. Okay, do you notice what I just did? I am not afraid of a super robot taking over the world, but based upon what I'm seeing, and given the fact that what's really happening is usually years ahead of what you see, but based upon what's coming out of places like Boston Robotics, for example, I think they're already there when it comes to replacing most of us. They really are. They're almost there. They're probably already there. So if the question is, well, Dan, don't they need all of us, useless eaters? I really don't know. I don't even know if the Georgia Guidestone prediction is valid any longer. Like on the Georgia Guidestone prediction, it's all like, well, you know, the world have the human population at something like 500 million people. So at this point, if we're 8 billion, that basically means, you know, definitely more than 80% of the people have to die. Okay, more than 80%. You know, let's just do the, I'm going to do the basic math right now here really quick because it's always good to do your math. I don't know. And I know you're saying, Dan, it's Memorial Day. Why are you doing this to me? Well, because I love you. That's why. Anyway, so let's do 0.5 divided by... I'm gonna assume the world population is 8 billion, but I don't know if that's true. Okay, so... yeah. Basically, about 94% of the people on Earth would have to die to get to the magical number that they want to have according to the Georgia Guidestones, assuming that's not all bullshit. But here's the deal. They might not even need 500 million at this point, folks. If automation and machine intelligence have reached the stage where it appears it has reached that stage, where most of the ordinary shit that people do can be encoded, and that computers can be trained to do them, and that essentially the food prep and growing food and harvesting food, you know, acquiring and purifying water, building shelters. I mean, if essentially you can automate the first the bottom half of Maslow's hierarchy, then yeah, most of us, probably almost all of us, are just not needed. It's not to say there won't be people. There will be. It just won't be you. And last but not least, because as you may or may not know, the last few months I've been listening to a couple of podcasters, YouTubers, activists, climate activists by the names of Dane Wigington and Guy McPherson. And they're not the same people. Like, they kind of, I think they've interviewed each other, but they definitely don't completely agree with each other. Although they agree on a lot. The main difference between Dane Wigington and Guy McPherson is Dane Wigington believes there is a global campaign of climate engineering ongoing right now, specifically in the United States, to convince people that there is no climate change. And I gotta tell you, there are days I look up at the sky and I kind of think Dane Wigington might be right. You know, a lot of the weather of the last 10 years, especially when I moved back to Indiana, you know, to do a whole compare and contrast, Indiana in 2014 versus Indiana in 2003, a lot of the weather's just been weird. Like, I remember, you know, I think 2014 or 2015, it seemed like we barely had a summer. It was so strange. It was so cool. Now, the sky was almost fucking cloudy year-round, and there sure as shit was some kind of activity occurring behind airplanes as they flew through the sky. But yeah, the weather seemed kind of pleasant. And that's the thing. If you believe Dane Wigington, that's on purpose. Like, that's by design. They want to convince people that, you know, basically it's like a kind of global climate confusion campaign. But, you know, that's the thing. I've been listening to Guy McPherson and Dane Wigington, and the one thing they both agree on, I think they kind of agree on, is that, well, they don't really agree on this either, actually. But what they both what Guy McPherson will mention is the aerosol effect, or the particle effect, the idea that the industry that is producing greenhouse gases is also producing particles that are cooling the planet, or at least blocking the sun. So essentially, some of the effect of pollution is offsetting the warming effect, and maybe a huge amount. There was a study done after 9/11 when they shut down airline flights, I think for a couple of days over the United States. And they found that the Earth's temperature, I should say, that the temperature that they measured in the United States started going up faster. You know, so here's the thing. There is a belief, I think there's a genuinely held belief now amongst climate scientists and researchers that the pollution effect, the particle effect, is actually offsetting the heating effect. And that if you stop, and this is where it's very, very kind of fucked up, if we stop the massive industrial activity, the Earth might, at least over the short term, warm a lot faster. And that means that all the methane, methyl hydrates, but all the methane that's trapped in permafrost around the Arctic Circle or in the Arctic, all that basically gases out faster. And you have runaway greenhouse effect. You have what's called Venus syndrome. And so Guy McPherson believes that we're about half a decade away from the end of the world. I mean, if you listen to Guy McPherson, and this is the thing, he seems like a serious man. He seems like an intelligent, serious man. He has a PhD. And as I mentioned in my last podcast, if you have a PhD, you're someone to be listened to, right? He's published papers in his field. I'm not going to be sarcastic. I think he's a serious gentleman, with an intelligent, reasoned position, and I don't have enough evidence to verify if he is right or wrong, but if there's any chance in hell that he's right, then the situation's really quite dire. And so one of the things that occurred to me, and again, we're still on the topic of nuclear war, is that if the powers that be, if the people that run the world know this, they must. Like, if Guy McPherson is right, the people that run the world must know this. And that's why, you know, that's why the whole climate engineering thing makes a lot of sense, because they probably know it can't save us, but what it can do is buy them time. Buy them time to fucking do whatever shit they need to do to get their house in order. But it could buy them time. And it certainly does confuse people. I mean, I know that I was one of those folks that was very confused by the weird climate patterns. And to the point that, you know, when some jackass might come on, you know, YouTube and say, hey, there's going to be an ice age, I would listen to him because it seemed to make sense. From my experience, the weather patterns were getting strange, especially when I moved back to Indiana for a while. It seemed like it was just getting colder, but that was an illusion. And if you believe Dane Wigington, that was an illusion brought to you by the Department of Defense. That was weather control. So, simply put, if Guy McPherson is right, then there's just no chance in hell that the people that more or less run the world don't know this. They must know this. So what do they do? So again, I could keep going, but my point is, if you look at the picture, and you're in charge. And again, this is one of those situations where you have to pretend to be the crocodile. You have to pretend to be a sociopathic ruler, okay? If you're a decent person, you will not understand why this is probably going to happen. Because from your perspective, especially if you're a good Christian, you would not be able to fathom how this could happen, okay? But if you're a realist, all right, and you're able to get past some of your inhibitions about accepting that there is evil. And if you're a Christian, but also a Christian who's read their Bible, so you know that evil's been part of the world for a long, long time. Evil's been around a while. So in following my reasoning, you kind of have to, look at it from the perspective of really a sociopath. And if you're the sociopath or one of the many that kind of thinks he or she runs the world now, And you look around the world at a bunch of grumbly people, and there might not be enough food to feed them. And oh, by the way, the oceans are dying, probably. And when things really go bad, there's no way the other nuclear reactors we use primarily to make nuclear weapons don't go critical. And then there's this whole runaway greenhouse effect, and what the fuck? And so at our crocodile meeting, we have our crocodile conversations, and some dude says, you know, back in the day during the Cold War, there was fear of this thing called nuclear winter. Now, folks, you need to think about this for a second. If we are really on the verge of runaway greenhouse, and I mean a few years, if not months away, from a blue Arctic event where there's no ice in the Arctic, they say 2019 will be okay. Okay, so maybe it's off for another year. But let's say 2020, we have a blue Arctic event. No ice in the Arctic. We have massive methane expulsions. And all of a sudden, we get into a runaway positive feedback. You know, and again, this is something that Guy McPherson believes will happen. And I'm basically asking you to assume for the sake of argument that he might be right. Or even if he's not right, he makes a compelling argument. And for the crocodile people, for the lizard people, for the scumbags who run the world, they're mostly worried about their own asses. So if you see the grumbly, crumbly world of angry people, and you know that it's going to be a massive nightmarish scenario pretty fucking soon, and somebody at your crocodile meeting raises their hand and says, well, listen, dude, you know, I remember when I was a kid reading about this nuclear winter. I promise you they've had these conversations. They've had them. I can promise you that's one. You know, if you want an explanation for all the fucking bunkers, don't look to the world's going to end through global heating. Because I'm going to tell you something. If we get into runaway greenhouse effect and Venus syndrome, there'll be no bunker on Earth that will be able to survive, okay? There will not be an ability to keep that bunker safe, okay? If the Earth's temperature heats up to hundreds and hundreds of degrees, it won't matter how deep you are in the ground, and you just won't be deep enough. That's the simple reality. That's the simple calculus, that there probably is no bunker for runaway greenhouse. And, you know, you come out in 20 years, and to what? The Earth's temperature has dropped to 200 degrees? Sorry, it's not going to work, okay? If you believe Guy McPherson, the recovery period for something like runaway greenhouse is in the millions of years. There is no conceivable way that you would survive in your bunker or through a generational bunker for millions of years. It just isn't realistic. However, if you say, well, Dan, we could do this nuclear winter thingy, and this will buy us time because we'll introduce all kinds of particles into the atmosphere, and in the process, we're going to kill pretty much everybody, or at least mostly everybody, and the ones we don't kill, well, a lot of them will simply die from disease, and so, yeah, in about 20 years, there'll be maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred million people at most on planet Earth, and radiation levels will have dropped, and all the reactors will have cooked off. Yeah, there'll be dead zones and radioactive zones, and it'll be pretty bad in some places, but the human race survives. And what's more important, crocodiles, and this is the thing, you have to imagine a smoky room of crocodiles having their crocodile conversation, you know, at their Bilderberg meeting or whatever. I don't give a fuck. But at the Bohemian Grove crocodile meeting, you can imagine a crocodile's pulling on their cigarettes and saying, yeah, this all makes sense. So basically, we just need a good old-fashioned nuclear war. That's why I think, and I do think, and then I'm also a Christian. So I see a lot of things in terms of religion, and I try to be careful because I am not a biblical scholar. I do not know. Number one, I approach specifically the book of Revelations, I approach that particular part of the Bible with great trepidation, with great care. There is a lot in Revelations, and it's very dense. That's number one. Number two, prophecy in the Bible is all throughout the Bible. The book of Daniel is filled with a lot of prophecy that many biblical scholars believe apply to even the current age we're in now. So when I talk about this and say my religion impacts my opinion, I am not saying that I have found evidence in the Bible that says there's going to be a nuclear war. That is not it. I have found no evidence of that. What I will say is that human failure and human stupidity and human hubris on huge scale, on a very large scale, is not a new story. It is an old story. It goes right back to the very beginning. But certainly a big part of the Old Testament is about human pride and failure on very large scales, at least relative to the people of the time. Such a large scale that entire cities were destroyed. And let me tell you something, a city being destroyed back in the day would have been a lot like destroying a country today, an entire nation being wiped out. If you can imagine, like, for example, the city of Sodom being wiped out, today an equivalent would be an entire country, just wiped out by God. God said, you know, listen, and gone, and it's gone. So yeah, I would say that the nuclear winter conversation has been had. It's funny, when I started this podcast, I had the presumption that I would go to other topics, but as you can see, this is a very dense topic. Now I'm going to give you an escape hatch, because yes, I do believe that I do think the odds are within 5 years there will be a very large-scale nuclear war. I think it's virtually certain that someone will use a nuke in the next 5 years. And I think it's almost as certain that that will lead to full-scale nuclear war. And the thing about, and I've said this before, the thing about nuclear wars, it's really important that you think about this when you think about what nuclear war is. The thing about nuclear wars and the problem with nuclear wars is the very weapons that are used to fight a nuclear war are extraordinarily damaging to the structures, institutions, technology, to the entire infrastructure that you would use to end a nuclear war, which means turn it off. So people will talk about limited nuclear war like it's an option. Listen, limited nuclear war might happen, but it won't happen because people, you know, read their Rand Corporation books from the 1950s. It'll happen because it simply stopped at that point. But the truth is, once a nuclear war starts, it is extremely unpredictable and extremely difficult to stop. And a lot of people will be operating on the basis of revenge. Listen, I gotta tell you, if an entire city gets nuked, even if it's our own government that nukes it, all they'll have to do is blame someone, and America will seek revenge. They will seek revenge. They will not want to believe for one fucking second that their government could do it to them. They will seek revenge. So a nuclear war will spin out of control very quickly. And then you add all the propaganda. We have been fed a lot of propaganda, both in terms of quote-unquote journalism, sarcastic quotes intended, but also in terms of entertainment, you know, TV shows, fiction, you know, written fiction that's chosen. Listen, they choose which books they promote. They choose which shows they promote. And there have been a lot of shows in recent years that kind of describe a post-nuclear war world in semi-romantic terms. You know, it's like that show, The 100. It kind of describes a post-nuclear war world in kind of adventurous, you know, terms and scenarios in a kind of a gender intersectional way. And so people get fed this bullshit that maybe nuclear war won't be so bad, or they get suckered into the nihilism of, well, it probably won't happen, and if it happens, there's nothing we can do about it. So yeah, I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen within 5 years, and I think it could be quite terrible. However, I'm going to give you an escape hatch. It's not a great escape hatch, because even in the best case scenario, any nuclear war is going to probably involve tens of millions of people dying, and that's the best case where it stops after a few cities. And that's what I hope. I hope that a few cities are destroyed and it stops, and here's how that works out. The first thing you need to recognize is that the human stupidity and arrogance and irrationality that led to the nuclear war that you're being told about on your mobile device is also the same human stupidity and irrationality and hubris that built the infrastructure of nuclear war. So before you get too stressed out, keep in mind, systems fail. Human systems fail all the time. And the system that allows countries to wage nuclear war is a system of both technology and people. And technology fails and people fail. I was reading an article on Zero Hedge today about some Air Force dudes near a nuclear missile site that were caught drinking beer. It's like, whatever. You know, I was in the service. People did shit like that. Is it great? No. But hey, I hate the crocodile, so I think the whole military thing is bullshit anyways. But anyways, I was reading this article, and it's like people are kind of like, oh my God, you know, how can people be drinking beer and whatever? And it's like, listen, wake the fuck up. There's a lot worse happening out there, if you ask my opinion. But one scenario that you can be hopeful about is that the systems that were built by these arrogant and stupid and sociopathic people, these hubris-ridden, fucking narcissistic pieces of shit, the one thing you can hope for is that their stupidity also ultimately went into engineering the system. And I don't mean the missile control systems. I don't mean the rocket motors. I mean the whole fucking system. I mean the logistics that make sure that if a missile needs to go through maintenance checks, that it continues to go through them. I'm going to let you on a little secret, folks. When I was in the Army back in the 90s, during that heyday period, when supposedly the Department of Defense lost, I don't know, like several trillion dollars, there wasn't a lot of money for maintenance, which is funny. I mean, I later found out that there were trillions and trillions missing from the DoD budget, but what I was being told as an Army officer is we don't have money for this and we don't have money for that, and you know your M1 tanks with their blown out engine packs, fuck you. So it's kind of funny. So when somebody comes back to me and says, well, Dan, what do you mean? This is what I mean. All of the missiles in our arsenal have to go through maintenance checks. If you believe that those maintenance checks are happening on a reliable basis, you're a fucking moron. Our entire missile infrastructure depends upon components being updated. If you think those components are being built correctly all the time, if you think the contractors are decent, hardworking folks who are making sure that America is a safe and strong place, rather than a bunch of crony fucks trying to shave a dime here and shave a dime there, listen, you're a fucking idiot. These are crony fucks. The fuckers that make the components that go into the system, and it's the missile system, the radar systems, the computer systems, the fuckers that make the software, the fuckers that plan these systems within the Department of Defense, these people are arrogant pieces of shit, and often they're not that smart. So here's your Hail Mary. Here's your escape hatch. And this is how I'm going to leave this podcast, because I didn't think I would spend the whole podcast on the subject of why I think there's going to be a nuclear war. But here is how I can give you something optimistic. The nuclear war is going to be held by imperfect people who are terrible pieces of shit. And so I would expect that nuclear war to succeed as much as their humanity succeeded, which means it failed. If we get to nuclear war, they have failed. They don't see it that way because they're crocodile sociopathic pieces of shit. But in essence, from a life history perspective, they failed. So why would I expect their war to succeed? It's entirely possible that their nuclear war does not succeed, that the technology fails, that people say no. I want to believe in my heart of heart that there are men and women of good conscience, not just in our military, but around the world, who will say no. I'd like to believe there are mothers and fathers who will say no. But here is the thing, and this is where it gets tricky. And this is why this is such a horrible mess, because it is a mess. And like most messes we deal with, 100% human constructed. Okay, this isn't some fucking act of God. God did not do this to us. We did this to ourselves. But here's the thing. Let's say there was this nuclear war, and let's say there was a revolt, and somehow it was prevented from occurring. If Guy McPherson is right, all we've really done is prevented an act that might have, and this is the horrible calculus. This is why it's so horrible, people. All we would have done is prevented an action that might have saved some fragment, not just of human life, but of life on Earth. A runaway greenhouse effect doesn't necessarily resolve itself. I mean, we could end up in a Venus syndrome and stay there forever. There's no guarantee that we somehow creep back out of it. Okay, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen. Not this time. You know, if it's happened before, okay, but there's no guarantee we get to that point and it reverses itself. So this is the horrible thought that goes along with the escape hatch. What if the only way to save the human race were to have, were for us to have basically a major nuclear war? What if that was the only thing left? Like, what if we'd so fucked up and trashed the planet that the only option left we had was to kill off most of the people, to send human civilization back 10,000 years, for the elites to live in their bunkers for 20 to 50 years, and for the Earth to essentially become, you know, a pretty cold place, a pretty cold, dark place for a few decades. But compare that to runaway greenhouse effect. Compare that to Venus effect. Listen, Venus is several hundred degrees. Like, I think it's 600 or 700 degrees on the surface. You're never going to make that work. If the Earth even remotely gets to that point, there is no way to make that work, ever. And even if it does heal itself in a million years, fine. That doesn't help one person alive today, even the crocodile people, even the rich people, even the people at the top. It does not help them. So yeah, I think there's going to be a nuclear war. I think it's going to be pretty bad. I think that it will likely be contrived, but it could also be accidental. I think things are getting that crazy. It could be a little of both. It could be that at those levels they've had conversations like this and that they're just waiting for the right trigger. Could be an incident in the South China Sea. Could be an incident between India and Pakistan that goes awry. Could be some crazy-ass terrorist in Europe that lights off a nuke given to them by the CIA. Could be a war between Israel and Iran. I mean, there are so many possibilities at this point. But what I will tell you is that once it starts happening, yeah, all bets are off. And the only thing you can hope for is that the incompetence that led us to that point also manifests itself in the action. And that's what I'll leave it at. Anyways, talk to you later.